Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Perfect pitch. Is it nature or nurture? This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Coming up later on today's show, Macedonian pianist Simon Terpceski performs music by Chopin in our studio. But first, it's believed that Mozart, whose piano concerto number 21 you're hearing in the background, could identify a single note from a tolling bell or a chiming pocket watch. He had what's called absolute pitch, commonly known as perfect pitch, the rare ability to identify a musical note without any other notes as a reference. Scientists in California have been identifying people with this skill and have found that it may have a genetic basis. We're also going to speak with a Harvard scientist who's been following the opposite trend, people who have no pitch, or at least very limited pitch. But joining us first is Jane Gitcher. She's a geneticist at the University of California at San Francisco. Jane, thanks for joining us on Soundcheck today.
Well, thank you, John. Glad to be here.
This study of perfect or absolute pitch, you took 2,200 individuals, gave them an online exam, 36 electronic tones, 36 piano tones. What did you find?
Well, we found three things. One thing that we were looking for was whether or not people had distortions in their pitch perception as they became older. Anecdotally, we had been told that people, their pitch was off as they got older. And what we discovered by looking at almost 1,000 subjects who indeed do have absolute pitch was that indeed, as subjects get older, they gradually hear tones or perceive tones at a higher frequency than the frequency that's actually given. In other words,
they're hearing sharp.
Yeah, they're hearing sharp, exactly. So in other words, if you're 20 years old and you hear a C, you'll say that's a C. But if you're 50 years old and you hear C, you might tend to say that's a C sharp.
Huh.
And it gets even worse as you get older.
All right, but at what point does genetics, you say there were three things you were looking for. Was a genetic basis for perfect pitch one of them?
No, not in this study. We had previously addressed that in another study. This study was only looking at all the perceptual data that had come in via our very large web-based study.
All right, so let me ask you just about that study, because there were 2,213 individuals, and the summary suggested that some 44% of them had what was termed extraordinary pitch perception, something
this
like 44%,
true.
Right?
Right.
That seems an incredibly high number, given that perfect pitch is so rare.
It is a high number, but you have to understand, people come into this study because they're interested in the concept of absolute pitch. And, of course, people who have absolute pitch are very interested in why they have this extraordinary ability. It's not something they've ever worked at. It's essentially innate. So, of course, we have a skew in the distribution of people who come into the study who have absolute pitch perception, and that's what we were hoping to attract.
So,
of course, our numbers don't represent what you would
see
in the general
population.
Okay. Yeah.
So what is perfect pitch, and how do these people know they have it?
Well, you defined it exactly the way we did. In the introduction to this program, we define absolute pitch for the purpose of our study as the ability to name a note with complete accuracy without any reference note. And people don't know how they are able to have this ability. Certainly there is an influence of early musical training. If one has never been exposed to a keyboard and to the names of notes, then you're not going to make the association between acoustical frequencies and the names of the notes. But if you are exposed to music, then if you have what we think is a genetic predisposition to developing absolute pitch, then you will manifest the trait.
So you could be born with, as you say, the genetic predisposition, but if you don't have that early childhood exposure to the naming of the notes and what they sound like, then that predisposition never actually blossoms into anything.
That's exactly our hypothesis, yes.
All right. Now, perfect pitch is pretty rare. It's one in 10,000 people. Is that what people are saying?
That's what people say. I have no idea who the first person is to say that.
All right. But so what makes you think that there's a genetic component? I mean, I guess the gold standard in studies like this is to get twins, you know?
That's right. That's right. And we are in the process of doing some twin studies, but that data are still preliminary. There are really two things that make us think there's a genetic basis for absolute pitch. First of all, there's the argument that, let's take the antithesis, the antithetical argument that, well, all you need is musical training to have absolute pitch. Well, that's clearly not true because many, many people have musical training at age 4, 5, 6, and they don't go on to have absolute pitch. So clearly there's some other ingredient. We did, as well as other laboratories, have done very careful analysis of the frequency of perfect pitch in different populations. And our study found that if you control for early musical training, that means that if you only include people in your study who've had musical training by age 7, then you are about 14 times more likely to have absolute pitch if you have a sibling who has absolute pitch than you are if you're just in the general population. That's something that speaks to the heritability of absolute pitch. Now, it could be that there are other environmental factors that we haven't considered and that we haven't controlled for. That's certainly a possibility. But
so it's a case of kind of, you know, slicing off each little possibility until you're left with the one that seems to be the correct
exactly.
answer.
Exactly.
Right. We're speaking with Jane Gitcher. She's a geneticist at the University of California at San Francisco. And Jane, professor of medicine and pediatrics, is that right?
That's correct.
Was there a sort of a pediatric interest here in trying to, you know, decipher absolute or perfect pitch?
Only a pediatric interest in the sense that I'm very interested in this interplay between genetic predisposition and environment. You know, early languages, having early language training, et cetera. But no, my interest actually stemmed from music. I was trained as a classical singer, and I, through that experience, was taught by many teachers and coaches who were excellent pianists and who indeed some of whom had absolute pitch, and I just couldn't get over how they could do this.
So can you develop perfect pitch if you don't have the gene for it?
Some people, in fact, who test as having absolute pitch in our study do claim that they have learned to have absolute pitch, and there are programs out there available if you surf the web that you can buy that claim to be able to allow you to have absolute pitch. So I really don't know. There are some claims in that regard, but the vast majority of people who enter our study claim that this is an innate ability. They've had it for as long as they knew about. In fact, it's quite interesting because many subjects will say that they went to, say, middle school and were in a middle school chorus and could name the notes, and suddenly they realized no one else could name the notes. So something they always had and just assumed everyone else had, but in fact they were quite different.
We're talking with Jane Gitcher about absolute pitch or perfect pitch. One opera singer who clearly was not blessed with perfect pitch was this one, Florence Foster Jenkins, who became legendary for her alleged tone deafness during the early 20th century. Talking about perfect pitch, and that is just perfectly awful from Florence Foster Jenkins. Joining us now is Michael C. Miller. He's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Mental Health Letter, and he's also an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, where he's written about research into the opposite condition, a condition called amusia. Michael, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
What is amusia?
Well, amusia, first of all, I would say that Florence Foster Jenkins, well, you captured it correctly. She probably was not tone deaf. She was probably merely bad.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people who, there's a mistake that's made that tone deafness is associated with an inability to sing. But in fact, it's there are a lot of people who can't sing who can hear pitches and can enjoy music. And you can even hear in the singing, that example that you gave us, that she clearly knew the direction of the pitch, and
right.
She was close, but not on target. People with amusia really cannot tell up from down with music. It's a little bit like a pilot who's not instrument rated, flying in a cloud and doesn't know up from down.
Is it similar to color blindness?
I think it is similar to color blindness, but. It is in a sense more profound because people will have ways of sort of identifying cues, and color blindness is often very specific to a couple of shades of color.
Exactly.
Whereas this is really a global problem.
All right. Now there are a lot of people out there, Michael, who say, "Oh, I'm tone deaf. I can't sing." What they really mean is that they're not good singers. How rare or how common is genuine amusia?
Well, amusia seems to be much more common than absolute pitch is. About 1 in 20 or 5% seem to have it.
Wow. That seems like an awful lot of people out there who are just not getting it when they turn on the radio and hear a song.
Right, but I'm also somebody who grew up with music, and I know a lot of people who are just simply not interested. And I'm reminded of the line from Catch-22 where the main character says to one of his colleagues, "You have flies in your eyes, that's why you can't see them." I think people who are amusic don't know that they have it because they're just not interested. And so I don't think it's really something that they suffer with. But they might walk in the other direction if you start putting on even the finest music.
All right, so we were talking with Jane Gitcher about whether there was a genetic component to perfect pitch. Is there a genetic component to amusia?
Probably there is. Absolute pitch is not easier to study, but it is more isolated and rarer. Amusia, in a sense, is harder to pick up and probably involves many, many different parts of the brain. Probably absolute pitch does too. But there's so many different parts of musical perception. There's the listening part, there's the processing part, there's the emotional part, there's the rhythm part. There seems to be some problem in the connections in various parts of the brain that are responsible for these different parts of music perception that are involved in amusia.
Now, it's said that people like President Ulysses S. Grant or Che Guevara were amusics, that they had amusia. How do we know that, and how long has this term even been around?
Well, I'm not sure we know that with any certainty. There's the famous scene in Motorcycle Diaries. It's famous amongst people who look at amusia, I guess, where everybody's doing one dance and Che Guevara is doing another dance. It's always interesting to go back and look at famous people and see what kind of diagnosis they may have had. But the reality is that the ability to even examine this has only been around for 5 years or so, as we've gotten into the ability to look at the brain in very detailed ways.
Well, not too long ago on Soundcheck, we did a program, a segment where we talked about some of the languages of the Far East that are tonally inflected languages, where the same syllable, depending on how you say it, can mean 3-4 different things.
Right, Chinese is that way.
Chinese, right. So at that point, if you're not able to tell whether pitch is going up or down and you happen to be Chinese, does that mean language also becomes gobbledygook to you?
Well, I don't know the answer to that specific question, but there is people have looked at, of course, there's this term prosody, which refers to the tonal elements of speech. People go, we can tell the difference between a statement and a question because of the inflection of, or the tone of the voice as it goes up and down. People who are amusic seem to do just fine at telling the difference between one or the other, probably because there are so many other elements to it. But then if that's translated into, if you take just the tones of the speech, then they get confused. So there's something about the verbal cues that help them, and it's not really clear why.
All right. Michael Miller is with us. He's editor-in-chief of the Harvard Mental Health Letter. Also, Professor Jane Gitcher from UCSF, University of California at San Francisco. Jane, I know amusia is at the opposite end of the spectrum from your studies of absolute pitch, but are there similarities? I mean, do you think similar parts of the brain are at play with each of these conditions?
I have absolutely no idea. I assume that there's going to be some auditory cortex, auditory processing issues in both, but I really don't know. In fact, I think that's one of the beauties of using a genetic approach to study a problem as complex as these, that you don't go in with any preconceived notion. You just let the genetics reveal what is the biology of the problem.
Mm-hmm. All right, what we're going to do after a break is take some calls. Actually, we can take a quick call right now, even though I haven't given the number out yet. Some of our Soundcheck listeners already on the ball and ever alert for an opportunity to call in. Our number is 212-264-7483, and we're asking, especially if you're among those who have perfect pitch, if so, how did you know? How does it help you, especially if you're a musician? Do you think you're tone deaf? Give us a call, 212-264-7483, or leave a comment on the Soundcheck page of our website at WNYC.org. Patricia joining us on the phone from New Jersey. Hi, Patricia.
Hi.
So you are a voice teacher, is that right?
I'm a voice teacher, and I teach all ages and specialize in teaching adults. I've trained hundreds and
You're going to have to say that again, Patricia. We lost you there for a moment.
Okay, I'm a voice teacher.
Right, and you train adults as well.
As well, and I've trained hundreds of singers among them. Few have...
All right, Patricia, we're having a little bit of problems with your line. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll take more calls, and also later on the show, the Macedonian-born pianist Simon Terpceski. People say that he has perfect pitch, he tells us, and he'll play live for us some music by Chopin here in our Soundcheck studio. Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Do people cringe when you sing? Well, you've got company, and not just from Sanjaya here, from American Idol. About 1 in 20 people truly has amusia, the technical term for tone deafness. With us are Jane Gitcher, a geneticist at the University of California at San Francisco, and Michael C. Miller, the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Mental Health Letter. And we have a number of our Soundcheck listeners on the phone at 212-264-7483. Jane, before we get to the phones, just another question about perfect or absolute pitch. It seems to be more common in East Asia, which, as we were discussing before the break, is, you know, in China, for example, you have a tonally inflected language. Do you see any correlation between those two?
First of all, I'm not sure that it's more common in East Asia. There's very little data on that coming out. And regarding the correlation between a tonal language and absolute pitch, that is a very fascinating question. It has been said that people with tonal languages, in fact, do have absolute pitch, but sometimes the terminology is used a little bit more loosely. In other words, the ability to say a particular phoneme on a certain pitch reproducibly is not really how we're defining absolute pitch. And so that is that's a really a different phenomenon than what we're studying with absolute pitch. It is true that we do have a number of Chinese subjects in our study at a higher frequency than you would anticipate in the American population. However, is that due to a higher gene frequency? Is that because all Chinese have absolute pitch, which obviously they don't? Or is it due to the fact that maybe there is educational pressure on Chinese kids in the United States to have early music training?
As you mentioned before, that kind of early musical training can bring out any tendency you might have to get
absolute pitch.
All right, let's give Patricia another try on the line from New Jersey, a voice teacher who has trained people of all ages, hundreds of singers, including adults. So, Patricia, now that we've got the phone lines worked out, what's your take on all of this?
Well, among the few students who have perfect pitch, and I've done my own private study over a period of 30 years, profess to have studied some form of solfeggio or an instrument in their early childhood.
When you say solfeggio, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do.
That's right, the Italian system, and understood that these perfect pitch people need a frame of reference. They just don't pick it out of the air. They've learned early in their childhood, it's their first language of music, to identify the notes. I've talked singers to experience the world through sound who cannot identify a pitch, and those people are developing perfect pitch in their adulthood. So there, to my experience as a voice teacher, there is no such thing as perfect pitch per se without an early education. In the beginning of their lives, they develop it in a very structured environment. And to answer the interesting Asian question, most of my Asian singers have perfect pitch. They learn how to read music very early. It's part of their general education.
Well, Jane, it seems like Patricia's experience sort of dovetails neatly with some of the things that you found in your study.
Well, I think that we're in agreement that early musical training is part of the key to developing this. But one would have to look, really carefully record the training of all students to know whether or not there was a direct one-to-one correlation between training and manifestation of AP. I would doubt that.
Okay. Let's take another call. Muriel joining us from New Jersey, and then I want to give Michael a chance to respond. Go ahead, Muriel.
Hi. I agree with the early training. I'm 84 years old now, and my godfather, was a violinist, and he started me first on the violin, and then we went to solfeggio. And what has happened to me, though, is as the doctor stated, my pitch is not absolute anymore, because when I hear an A, or I might hear A sharp instead of A.
Hmm.
And in other words, my pitch has dropped a half a tone
the
years.
You see the finger on the A on the keyboard, you know it must be an A, but you're hearing it as an A sharp.
Right. Exactly.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Muriel. And let's go back to Michael Miller, editor-in-chief of the Harvard Mental Health Letter. Michael, we're going to get a call or two about tone deafness, but all of this talk about, perfect pitch, absolute pitch, and how changeable and how maybe not absolute it is, does it give you any pause to think that, maybe there are more gradations of gray than we might think?
Well, I think certainly there are. One thing that I was going to break in and say a moment ago was that one thing I think listeners have to remember is that, and I think Jane, I hope, would agree with me on this, is that there's really no such thing as pitch without a brain. That pitch itself is a perception that's a construction in our brains. And of course, as you train your brain to respond to pitches in the environment, you're going to train the ability to focus on a particular pitch are certain gradations and the ways in which pitches relate to one another. I think, though, that absolute pitch, as Jane is describing it, is really a different, a very different and rare concept. So I guess I'm disagreeing with the callers on that one.
Well, that's an interesting concept of there being no pitch without a brain. It's kind of like, you know, the tree falling in the forest. Does it make a noise? I mean, if something is vibrating 440 times per second, isn't that an A, whether our brain is there to hear it or not?
Yes, although the experience of the A, I mean, this is getting a little metaphysical, maybe, but the experience of the A is something that our brain produces, and the brain is going to pick up that vibration, but whether you're going to perceive it as an A or not, or whether you're going to perceive it as a tone that makes musical sense to you or not, even whether you call it an A or not, is something that's a property of, it's a construct of the brain.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones and get someone who does not have perfect pitch. Lenny, joining us here in Manhattan.
Hi.
Lenny, I guess you don't have perfect pitch,
the
is that right?
The best way to explain, in third grade, they gave us a test to see what instrument we should learn, and when the results came back, the music teacher took me aside and said, did you understand the result, the directions?
So when you were played these various, I mean, I assume there were some melodies or something being played for you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a long time ago, but they played notes and melodies, and my daughter once put a 33 record on 45, and I didn't notice it.
Well, now, can you enjoy music? Do you sing?
Music.
Or?
I love music, and I can sing quite pretty well, I'm told.
Huh.
But I have no idea what, you know, what's coming out, in the sense of I can't pick it up, I can't mimic somebody's voice or anything like that. But if I practice, I can get it. I have a decent baritone voice.
So, but you maintain that you're tone deaf.
Like I said, I can't tell if something's right or wrong. Huh. It's so far off, like that woman you played before.
Right, Michael. Is that a degree of amusia, or is that something completely different?
Well, no, that sounds actually like amusia to me. Lenny, I'm glad that you can enjoy music, but it does sound exactly like what people describe when they describe amusia, that it's the inability to kind of place the sound in relation, the pitches, for instance, in relation to one another. I mean, the fact that you can actually learn to sing is a little different, but again, this has more to do with the what you're hearing than what you're singing.
All right, let's. There is one other comment that a couple of people have been making, which is that, and we sort of alluded to it at the beginning of the program with Mozart. People who can hear something once and then play it back identically. Jane, is that a function of perfect pitch, or is that just being a really great mimic and having a great memory?
Well, I don't really know the answer to that question, but I think that having absolute pitch ability certainly could be a major player in that. Yeah, I don't know.
But I guess what I'm saying is, would you define that as, a hallmark of perfect pitch, the ability to do that sort of thing?
I think, autistic individuals often have this, not often, but sometimes have this ability to hear things and then sit down on the piano and just play it. And I would say that absolute pitch could be a component of that, could easily be a component of that. Whether that's the whole story, I don't know.
Okay. Well, we'll need to leave it there. It's a fascinating topic, and lots more callers on the line wanting to share their thoughts about it. Check out the comments section of our soundcheck page on the website at WNYC.org to see what other people are saying about ideas of tone deafness and perfect pitch. We've been speaking with Professor Jane Gitcher from the University of California at San Francisco and Michael C. Miller, who is editor-in-chief of the Harvard Mental Health Letter. And Jane, Michael, thank you both for joining us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
In a moment, we will be doing something perhaps related tomorrow on the show, though. The glory days of Cuban music evoked by several recent CDs, including a new album by Gloria Estefan. We'll hear why. And in just a moment, the pianist Simon Trpceski. People told him that he had perfect pitch from an early age. Nowadays, he's earning comparisons to some of the great Chopin interpreters, and he'll show us why as he plays live for us next.
The way we danced till three, the way you changed my life. No, they can't take that away from me. No, they can't take that away from me.